Thank you, Angela, for such a rich presentation, lecture. If there are any questions right off, okay. I mean, we've discussed this a little bit, but I thought to perhaps open up what you've presented today and to think through how socialist realism somehow translated across the so-called Iron Curtain. There are two things that come to mind in relation to the exhibition and some of the exhibits that we have in the vitrines. One is a publication called Seven Soviet Arts by Kurt London, who was an American who happened to be in Moscow in the 30s. And I guess his representation of the debates around the Writers' Congress came to epitomize how socialist realism was received in the United States. In a publication called The God That Failed, which preceded somehow the foundation of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, in which a number of writers basically presented their confessions about their somehow relation, I mean, their brief kind of interludes with communism. Basically, communist writers turning ex-communists. And Louis Fisher, who's one of the writers, during his time in the Soviet Union, was confronted by this very gap that you were speaking about between the reality that one sees and the kind of ideal that writing and art production under the banner of socialist realism was aspiring to. And he, in his dismay and the contradictions that you also speak about, was, you know, going to publish a book about what he saw. And those that were around him, that were kind of showing him around, he had obviously gone with the Communist Party, were like, you know, what's the point, right? By the time your book goes through the censors and everything else, it will be a year, and by the time that year is over, this will no longer be true because we would have arrived at the ideal. The quote that, and this is then his kind of realization of what socialist realism was, and I read, "The Soviets knew the hypnotic effect of the great dream. And as the promised future faded into the past, they strove to keep alive the trust in delayed benefits. Among other things, they ordered all writers in the middle of the 1930s to treat the present as though it did not exist and the future as if it had already arrived. This literary device became known as socialist realism." So in your discussion of Lukas and Lipschitz and this kind of their understanding of socialist realism as that which we haven't arrived at versus this kind of asynchronicity of the reading that someone like Louis Fisher in his kind of very brief escapade into, you know, the villages encountered. Could you kind of help us think through that and think through how socialist realism as a doctrine kind of translated across?
Yeah, thanks, Nida. It's a kind of dense comment and question. The central question is like how the Soviet 20s were dealing with a pre-socialist past, right, with tradition as opposed to the 1930s. Mm-hmm. Why I mentioned the Stalinist double turns, 1928, the so-called Great Turn, when he used the prolet cult and the proletarian cadres in order to get rid of the those kind of traditionalists of the 1920s during the cultural policies of the new economic period, yeah. new economic policy period of Lenin. And then, with a second turn in 1932, he used the traditionalists that he tried to eliminate to get rid of the prolet cult. So I guess the question is, how does one deal with the tradition? From a Leninist perspective, right, as opposed to a prolet cult, The tradition cannot be proletarianized. This is what Bogdanov was proposing, as opposed to Lenin, to read, you know, from Plato to Leibniz according to the consciousness of the proletariat. Whereas the Leninist take was that within the tradition itself, there are ideals of liberation that are dormant, that could be uncovered or need to be uncovered for the emancipatory present. So what Stalin did, I would say, is that he kind of circumvented this dialectical historical temporality, kind of a very nuanced dialogue between the past, the present, and what is to come, for the sake of, on the one hand, turning the past into kind of this endless pool of pastiche appropriation, it sounds a bit postmodern, and on the other hand, short-circuiting to the future itself. But of course, the question, and I mean, this never got exhausted in the Soviet Union, then what is the adequate form of representation, right? How do you represent the future that is the present that we have achieved? And this is, I mean, this question itself allowed for a variety of debates within, like, even the most kind of schematic and doctrinarian positions. But I guess, like, I mean, I know I'm not answering your question, but in a sense, this is the kind of a mode of pastiche, in a sense, that got reappropriated in the 80s by the Russian Soz art as well. That to break from the language of Stalinism is used, kind of the logic of Stalinism as kind of a postmodern pop art to turn it against itself at the same time. Yeah, okay. But I mean, I haven't been dealing with the reverberations of socialist realism in a comparative sense outside of the Soviet Union so much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you so much for this very rich lecture that you gave. I see from what you're describing similar schemes that are happening now. If you look how we deal with critic and how this idea of critic has changed, if you look how speculative realism dealing with that. But my question goes in a completely different direction, and it goes also a little bit outside of your lecture. I was just wondering, when the people saw this CCF campaigning with abstract art in the 50s, what did the people, citizen of the Soviet thought? Was it like, oh, they're in the past, we're in the future, because future arrived in our art, whereby they are looking just to the past that we had in the 20s. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could perhaps elaborate on that, just if you think.
Yeah, that's a brilliant question. I mean, I cannot deal with like, sort of like the audience reaction as an empirical figure. I don't know. But one thing that was very interesting and fascinating is the way in which the exhibitions of abstract expressionists in Moscow became so influential for a generation of painters who were studying in, especially in St. Petersburg, because St. Petersburg always had a more kind of a rigid neoclassicist school of socialist realism rather than kind of the painterly freedom within limitations that was allowed by the Moscow School of Socialist Realism. There are lots of occasions when all these new students, artists, confronted the work of abstract expressionists, and especially I can speak from, let's say, the impact that these exhibitions had in Armenia, when in the aftermath of the Khrushchev's thaw, the liberalization, but also the impact of the American exhibitions in Moscow. In 1972, you had the establishment of the first Museum of Modern Art in Yerevan, of course, okayed by the KGB, which is a very, it wasn't like a dissident project, but it provided the kind of the official opposition to the official discourse. But what these painters took, at least the Armenian painters of the 60s and 70s, was a sort of like a strange connection to their so-called national roots. Via Arshil Gorky, via abstract expressionism, that grounded, let's say, national content, national understood and kind of ethno-folkloric terms, in modernist forms. as that connection with a kind of European universalism that for them the Soviets were undoing. So I think within the national traditions you can find a new development in the 60s and 70s that we could call Soviet national modernism, that we could in some sense see derivative, not only but partially derivative of the impact of seeing, let's say, the liberated gesture of Jackson Pollock or Arshil Gorky in Moscow. But yeah, I cannot talk about general audience reactions, who was in the past, who was in the future.
And just a quick question, since you started with the Soviet encyclopedia and its entry on Diamat, to my knowledge, and I don't know if you can know more about it, Lifshitz wrote the entry on modernism from the 50s to almost to his death, and ended up endorsing what was to a certain degree as no longer petit bourgeois or bourgeois at all, but rather as anti-bourgeois, for instance, conceptual art. Are you aware of this, and can you tell us something about this?
No, I know the opposite. Like, I mean, his kind of programmatic, of course, like Lifshitz was publishing systematic work, but he was also, because he was very marginal, he had to do a lot of publicist work. He called this like the new form of slavery as a writer. And a lot of his work is polemical as well. And up until, I mean, the late 60s, 70s, the seminal article, polemical article he published, Why Am I Not a Modernist? Is just like a frontal attack against modernism as form of bourgeois consciousness, and he was very well aware of the neo-avant-gardes, both in Europe and in the US, and he never embraced conceptual art. I'm not sure, it would be interesting to find out, but again, like, it's really a good question why Lifshitz is not available in English, and it's not accidental, because it's horrifying. He's like a homophobe, he's anti-feminist, he's this and that. You can never detach him from the very Soviet context that he's rooted. Like, the Soviet context is gone. To bring back Lifshitz is like, it's a kind of scandalous act, in a sense. But yeah, I'll do more investigation. I think until the very end of his life, he was like a staunch supporter of socialist realism as opposed to bourgeois forms of Western art.
I mean, it's more like a comment than a question. Actually, it concerns Lukács and his essay on the meaning of contemporary realism, because I was kind of struck by, I guess you did it intentionally because you focused on Lukács and Lifshitz, but the way that Lukács in that text in particular, which is probably the most well-known defense of socialist realism, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, makes a very interesting analogy, or makes a kind of a draws back to modernism and to kind of the subjectivity of the modern artist. Let's say the kind of the abstract expressionist prototype of a free spirit of Jackson Pollock or somebody like that. And he basically says the following, if I recall it correctly, that, you know, and this is, I think, the conundrum of representation, how to represent. He says, well, the true consciousness of communism is as equally difficult to represent as the false consciousness of the bourgeoisie, right? But then the subject, the subjectivity that is, you know, the kind of the subjectivity behind this ideal of the modern artist is, as he describes it, like a godless, lost individual. Somebody's like Koi, who is continuously staring in this godless abyss. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering whether this is something that you feel as a productive channel to think about this particular kind of, I guess, binaries that we are continuously orbiting around also in this project. And I guess you had the chance to see the exhibition. to bring the exhibition into the conversation a little bit. That's the whole point.
Yeah, I went through the exhibition rather quickly, and I need to spend a lot more time. But yeah, I mean, this is a. I mean, I guess also it's an interesting question to ask, right? What's the Marxian, Leninist, Lukacian notion of the individual? Because it's not about the elimination of the subject or the elimination of the individual, but how do you position the individual dialectically in relation to the collectivity, to the whole, to the ability of the subjective consciousness to develop and capture the objective world of contradictions, right? So I think this is something that Lukács and Lifshitz both upheld. You can yell and say and scream, this is humanism, this is bad, and so on, but they never abandoned the question of consciousness that Lenin provided them kind of an entry to via Hegel. So yeah, but I need to also reread I need to rework as well on the question of like who is the artist facing the abyss. But yet, I mean, I guess in the socialist.
The abyss in the other case against
none. Yes. Yeah.
There'll be more time later.
When did it happen that these Russian artists were so enthusiastic about abstract realism, abstract expressionism? When was it? What year?
You mean my comment, the comment I made?
No, when they were so enthusiastic. Where did you see them? In what time?
Oh, in the 60s and 70s.
In the 60s.
Yes.
In the end of the 50s, Pollock was in Berlin in excessive way in the art school, in the University of the Arts. And I am a témoin, wie sagt man, ein Zeuge. We weren't enthused at all. I was studying in the art school at that time. We were bored. We were bored. And the alternative to your realistic social realism is not abstract expressionism or modernism. The alternative is an art that is free, if I am allowed to say, an art that is only following its own rules. And we have the example of Karl Hofer. Probably you all know Karl Hofer. He was an editor of a periodical art magazine in the 7, 8. And there was an article in favor of Russian realism, and we should learn Russian realism in the time. And Hofer said, an art that is dienen. So, eine Kunst, die einer Idee dient, ist ein Social realism prostitution. The art is to be free, to follow its own laws. Mm-hmm. And it ends up with abstract realism, abstract expressionism, but it is not the alternative to social realism.
Yeah,
is an order of how to paint, and you should be allowed to paint as you want.
Yeah, this is what exactly they thought, basically, that there's like, from the 60s and 70s on, this is just a very short answer, there's a kind of double system developing, right? One is the official art, state commissions and so on, which a lot of artists took up to earn money, to earn living. They call this Khaltura, which in Russian means like faking your way through. And then the real art would be, the kind of spiritual expression of your true soul, which you do at home, alone, in your studio, enclosed. So, yeah, but thanks for the comment.
Thank you, Angela, for such a great discussion. And we'll have Angela back during the panel discussion later. We're going to be back after a short break at